The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I always get into Ubers and ask them to put Radio 4 on. And it's always woman's out, and it's always an Asian taxi driver, and they're always talking about vaginas. And I'm just dying in the back. Like, sorry, uncle. And then I thought, and finally it will be me. And now I will be the voice talking about vaginas. And I love it.
With thanks to Baileys, this is the Women's Prize for Fiction podcast, celebrating women's writing, sharing our creativity, our voices, and our perspectives, all while championing the very best fiction written by women around the world. I'm Vic Hope, and I'm your host for season 6 of Bookshelfie, the podcast that asks women with lives as inspiring as any fiction to share the 5 books by women that have shaped them. Join me and my incredible guests as we talk about the books you'll be adding to your 2023 reading list.
Hello. Now, you might notice that our sound is a little fuzzy today. Apologies. We had a little technical mishap, but Anita and my conversation was too good not to share. So I really hope you'll forgive the slight tinniness on my side. Enjoy. I'm thrilled to be joined on this week's episode of Bookshelfie by none other than award-winning broadcaster Anita Rani, well known as one of the lead presenters on BBC One's Country File and a range of shows, both Channel 4 and the BBC, covering topics from family budgets and waste plastic to Bollywood and the partition of India. Anita is also a familiar voice on radio, having worked for the BBC Asian Network and Radio 6 Music, and is now the host of BBC Radio 4's Woman's Hour alongside Emma Barnett. Alongside her broadcasting work, Anita is a successful writer, publishing her Sunday Times best-selling memoir, The Right Sort of Girl, back in 2021, and has recently branched out into fiction with her first novel, Baby Does a Runner, out now.
How often do you get to read?
I mean, a lot, because I have to for work, which is a sad thing to say, really, but it's also a blooming joyful position to be in. Yeah, Woman's Hour. Not just read for work, but read amazing books for work. For pleasure these days? Not as much as I'd like to. I mean, I've had quite a mad year, what with one thing and another, writing. But Sundays, and just before bed, actually, I do like to read half an hour to wind down.
So if it's not for work, what sort of books do you gravitate towards to wind down?
I'm not somebody who kind of just falls in love with one genre. I'll just pick up all sorts of stuff and just dip in and out. One of those people who kind of goes through phases of buying books thinking, oh, I'll read that because it'll make me seem clever. And then read like the first chapter and then it just sits there.
It's like actually what I really fancy is a thriller.
Yeah.
What a page turner.
Exactly. Give me something that's going to make me fall in love and make me weep.
Yeah.
But you know, the truth is I did not grow up in a household full of books. My mum and dad were really busy running a factory, and me and my brother used to get taken to the factory after school, and then they didn't read to us. My school was amazing. My mum and dad were just too busy. What they did was tell us stories. My mum would tell me epic tales before bed and sing to me, but books were not read to us. But my school was amazing, and my English teacher particularly my sort of GCSE and A-level English teacher, was my favourite teacher. She was pretty much the only teacher that liked me, or should I say, tolerated me. And madly enough, three days ago, I just started the sort of tour, press tour for the novel that I'm here to promote. My English teacher was at the Bradford Lit Fest. I didn't know, and she came up to me at the end of the at the end of my talk, and her husband said, "There's someone here to see you. It's Mrs. Bird." And we both burst into tears, and she hugged me and cried and cried and cried. We're crying now, just thinking about it.
And you just got sort of the emotion.
Yeah, just with her, to be seen.
Yeah.
Just to be seen. I think, you know, when, school was amazing and I loved it, but it was also really difficult. And like, I made a joke about her being the only teacher that tolerated me, but yeah, she really was. She was just kind and encouraging and open-hearted. And I just thought, she sees something that no one else sees, and it only takes one person. And that's why teachers are amazing. Teachers are incredible. You do a great job. We love you.
Or that novel that you're clutching.
Yeah.
The hard copy of Baby Does a Runner. We'll talk about it in just a moment, but we're also going to talk about that journey you've taken through books, the books that have shaped you, that have made you who you are. And your first book, Shelfie book, is Sophia, Princess Suffragette Revolutionary by Anita Anand. A journalist and BBC presenter brings to light the extraordinary story of Sophia Duleep Singh, a woman born into riches who becomes an avid campaigner for women's suffrage. Meticulously researched and passionately written, this enthralling story of the rise of women and the fall of empire introduces an extraordinary individual and her part in the defining moments of recent British and Indian history. How can you pick this one?
Because growing up in the UK, you just don't know history.
We don't know much history other than that's been chosen for us.
Yeah. So I was thinking about, how do I phrase this all like for the last 2 days? My history has been whitewashed.
Yeah.
And that's not just unfair on me, because I've been denied my history. It's unfair on everybody. Also, it's a lie. You know, we're not being told the truth about what happened. And so on many, many, many levels, we're all being kept in the dark and ignorant. And once you realise the truth, or whatever that means, or kind of understand that so much more happened, something explodes inside you. So I've done two things. I went on this incredible journey and filmed my Who Do You Think You Are? She's life-changing, like absolutely life-changing, because it connected me to my ancestry, connected me to the women of my past, and told me what actually happened to those women. And it fundamentally changed who I am in that moment. You see it happening on TV. You see the moment it happens, where something in my gut just explodes and it all comes out. And from that moment, I feel like I've been on a journey that's actually directly led to me writing this book. But then when I picked up Sophia by Anita Anand, yes, it's an Anita is amazing. And, you know, if anybody wants another podcast recommendation, I'm going to give her a shout out, because she does a brilliant history podcast called Empire with William Dalrymple. So if you are interested in colonial history, particularly set in Indian history, then that's an amazing podcast. But yeah, she wrote a book about this a princess called Sophia, whose father was the last Maharaja of Punjab. I am Punjabi. It's a northern state in India, the last state to be annexed by the British. And it's where the Kohinoor diamond was. So Maharaja Duleep Singh, his father, Ranjit Singh, the great warrior king who presided, the king of this whole region that was vast, used to wear the Kohinoor diamond on his arm. I know, it's so romantic just thinking about him, right? He was quite ugly, had one eye, and he had many, many, many wives, lots of sons. But his last wife was the daughter, I hope I'm getting this right, Anita, because this is from memory. I read it when it first came out. Was the daughter of, I think he was the man who looked after the horses. So she wasn't noble, and she was much, much younger than him. And she had his youngest son. And when Maharaja Duleep Singh died, the British kind of saw their opportunity to take over and annex this great state of Punjab. And this little boy, I mean, it's an amazing story. I'm not going to give it away because you need to read the book, but all the other sons try to get the throne. It's like proper Game of Thrones situation. But all weirdly die in strange circumstances. They're all sort of trying to kill each other off or whatever. So it's a battle for the throne. Until there is just the son of the last wife, the lowly born daughter of the horse guy. And his son is just a little child. And she says, fine, he's going to sit on the throne, but I'm going to be the sort of queen mother, and I'm gonna, so she's sort of protecting her son. Anyway, the British do what they do best, and they basically get her prime minister to start, basically get Indians to stab each other in the back. And they imprison her. So the queen is imprisoned and they take the child, this little, the king, and they give him to a Scottish couple who are Christians, who eventually convert into Christianity. And then as a 9-year-old, he's brought to the UK and he's made the godson of Queen Victoria. And he's brought up as a noble kind of exotic Indian prince in the court of Queen Victoria. And he has 4 children and one of them is Princess Sophia. And they are born in Britain. She's half Indian, so she's brown. Mm-hmm. And she has this incredible story and she eventually becomes a suffragette.
And I had no idea.
Yeah, no, because when I saw Princess Suffragette Revolutionary, they're not 3 words that I would at all associate. And knowing that this was a story that incorporated Indian history.
Exactly.
I was taken aback.
I think there's loads of these stories that exist of people being brought to the UK and kind of living here and having children. And it's like I said, we just didn't know. So thank goodness Anita Anand wrote it. And then when I read it, you know, it's so simple, isn't it? Someone who looks like you, who is just so part of British establishment, but you've had no idea.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
It feels so, mobilising.
Mobilising, exactly. And links and directly to you. And then you're like, well, why doesn't anyone else know this? And where is she in all the films and all the literature? And the tragedy is, you know, her father was never allowed to go back and reclaim his throne. And, you know, it's a very tragic ending. And none of the 4 children ever had any children. So their line is ended. And there is a bit in the book that says that it was done on purpose. You know, there was a conscious effort to stop this line so that they can never reclaim the throne of the great Punjab. Devastating story. Cruel. So cruel. But this is a very empowering book. And so Sophia had to be on the list because, yeah.
Very important. I mean, as you said, history has not been represented. And you mentioned a little earlier about feeling seen at school. Did you ever feel represented by stories?
Not really, no. But yes, here's the thing about stories. I was able to see the universal, right? Because nobody looked like me growing up. There was no Asian girls on TV, apart from good old Mira Sayal when she popped up when I was a teenager and changed the game. And thanks, Mira. There's a generation of us who are not accountants because of you. but you kind of find, you know, Pippi Longstocking, bloody loved her. She was my girl. You know, with her monkey as a mate and her pigtails and a rebellious nature. So I think when you're children, you don't need to, you do need to see yourself, but I always think, I wonder why people find it difficult to relate to stories of women of colour, because I am able to relate to stories of women of all backgrounds, right? Because I can see the universal. So if I can do it, everyone should be able to do it, right?
It's like I remember when there was an uproar about Hermione and Harry Potter being played by a black actress in the stage. And I remember being so confused because when I was reading it as a child, I'd always thought, oh no, I'm exactly like her.
Yeah.
I never even thought twice about the fact that I was exactly like her. In your memoir, Anita, The Right Sort of Girl, you include lessons for your younger self, including freedom is complicated, your anger is legitimate.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about these sections, why you wanted to include them?
Because freedom is complicated and girls... your anger is legitimate. Because when I wrote the memoir, it was an amazing process. And then I wrote it during lockdown and kind of sitting with your childhood. It's quite an exercise to do, thinking about why you are who you are. People often ask, how is it that you, as a brown woman from the north, you're in this space? How have you managed to get there? And it's a question that's asked a lot. And I've never really thought about how. And so went on this journey to write the memoir. I knew exactly why I was writing it. I'll tell you the story, actually. So basically, when the Obamas first came to the UK, that first visit, I remember watching the news and Michelle Obama was in a school in Islington and she was sitting in the round with a group of girls who were all black and she looked at them all and said, I am you.
Oh, it's going to make me cry just saying, thinking about it.
Morning, and it's seeing her and when she went on her becoming tour.
Yeah.
And it honestly, like a rock star standing out the O2. I remember sitting there and the whole row of us just in tears.
Yeah.
And I felt like, oh my God, I needed this. I needed to hear this.
Yeah, absolutely. And it made me really well up. It makes me well up now thinking about it. And I remember thinking, I think people see success and think you've had some sort of privilege to get there. and that I couldn't possibly do it myself. You know, Vic Hope's there because, you know, she's something different to me. You know, I could never do it or whatever. So I needed to write this for all those kids and say to them, I am you. And I get it.
Because that's where I came from.
Yeah.
And here's all the things that I overcame. Here's all the things.
Yeah. I see you.
And sometimes we need to take stock and hold on to those things because you can forget as you continue on your journey. And sometimes you just need to remind, whether it's a reminder from someone else, a reminder that you're giving yourself.
Exactly. And so that's why. And then my sort of device was to write this memoir to my 16-year-old self. And the reason I did that is so that I couldn't bullshit. Because you can't bullshit your 16-year-old self because she's living it. You can't make it up because she's living it and breathing it. So you need to address whatever it is she's going through. And that's why freedom is complicated. Because when you are, certainly for me, being a Punjabi Yorkshire lass, grew up in the 80s and 90s, you know, there was definitely a lot of complications about, you know, before I've even stepped out into the world where there's huge expectations or not. I don't even know if people have expectations of me. I don't even think people see brown women, to be honest, or at least don't see us in a full capacity, in a very binary way. But you have to overcome the complicated issue of being born into a South Asian family. So I start by saying, you know, when I was born, my grandma said, we don't celebrate girls. So before I've even opened my mouth, the minute I was born, no mind anything else.
You didn't do anything.
She has a vagina. Oh,
uh-oh.
Oh, dear. What are we going to do with that? So, yeah, so I needed to just talk, just needed to get it all out, yeah. Get it off my chest. And I got permission from Emma. And she said, do it, because obviously, you know, it's like, I'm going to write a memoir. You might feature. Yeah. And she said, write it for me, say all the things I could never say, and, you know, go for it. So, and then anger is legitimate, because we are constantly told that we're not to be angry, right? It's like, oh, no, don't be angry. And, you know, we know all the tropes, particularly for a black woman, and, you know, and you're all the angry black woman trope and all the rest of it. And, see, no, hang on a minute. So I just really needed to sit there and just express that I am angry and I'm allowed to be angry, and it's good.
Brimming with multi-layered characters, this debut novel from acclaimed poet Mona Arshi revolves around Ruby, a small girl who, coping with her mother's increasing mental illness, decides to stop speaking. The book sensitively and beautifully explores how and why we refuse to tell the stories that shape us.
How did this story shape you? Oh my God. Mona Arshi, I bow down at your beautiful feet as she is next level. So if my book is like this, me sort of ranting, bah, 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 Mona's is like, a nightingale. I mean, she's a poet.
Yeah.
It took my breath away. I could not believe what I was reading. Just the wet, her ability to express so much with so few words. I am in awe of, first of all, her writing and beauty of her writing and the pain she manages to express. And the fact that her main character doesn't speak, it's just unbelievable. And you don't, it's one of those books where I don't want to give it away. I just think everyone should read it. You can't believe what's unfolding as you turn the page. And it is about mental health, and it is about, you know, silence and observation. And it's about this little girl and the complications of growing up with a mother with mental health issues, and also being a little brown girl in the world, and her older sister, who's also very complicated, and about abuse. And these are things that are just never spoken about, but she does it so magnificently. So it really, really took my breath away. And also, you know, finally, I'm picking up books by amazing South Asian women who are writing these stories. Like, finally, we are telling stories. And that's just joyful.
Talk to me about your transition from writing a memoir to writing your work of fiction.
I love writing. I've always loved writing, which is why Mrs. Bird was such a powerful moment. The memoir... Okay, you'll get this. It's the first space in my life where I have complete creative control. You know, no one's telling me. There's no producers, there's no directors. It's not. So I'm not waiting for someone to say, you've got the gig, or yeah. Usually you haven't got the gig.
Oh, that's your story as well.
That's my story. And but lots of people have other people like their stories. But there was just no way I wasn't going to write it.
This is truly your story.
Yeah, it's my story, but also it's my tone of voice.
Yeah.
And I just love that solitary feeling. I love getting up early. I can't do 4 a.m. I know there's a 4 a.m. crew out there that love doing a 4 a.m. wake up. But fine. I do quite like getting up when everything else is quiet and doing a couple of hours. and just letting it come out.
What a special space and time that is.
Yeah, it's magic. Cup of tea.
Yeah.
Hot water first, cup of tea. And then just seeing what comes out. And I just loved it. Then it's like, yeah, of course I want to write a novel. Love to write a novel. Yeah, bring it on. And then you sit down and you're like, oh my God, what was I thinking when I said yes? But sometimes life offers you amazing opportunities. You've just got to take them, haven't you? I mean, that's just generally the way. I'm sure you live the same way. And I've always fancied writing a novel, you know. And it was the story I had to tell. Had to tell the story. Had to tell baby's story. Had to create her. And these women, there's lots of women in it, and they all live. They're very real in my head. So I've just had these characters talking to me for a while. And so it was just amazing. Loved it. But don't ask me how and when I wrote it, because I can't even tell you. Trains, hotels, traveling a lot for work. Hotels are amazing to write in because there's no distraction. You don't have to get up and put a wash on.
You don't have to load a dishwasher. You don't have to do any of it.
It's actually ideal. Brilliant. Your protagonist, baby, has to deal with a mother and her various aunties. As you said, lots of women in this story constantly asking her when she's going to settle down. I know this is a piece of fiction. It's a novel, but how much of your experience did you draw from?
I think there's going to be a lot of Asian women who are going to relate to this. Yeah. And possibly wider than that. If you come from a community or a culture where it's expected of you to settle down at some point, yeah, I mean, the auntie network or the Illuminati, it is their business to know your business. Yeah, they're on a case. So she's 35 and she turns 36 at the beginning of the book. And she very much tells her mum that she doesn't want a birthday party, but she'd quite like to go home and see her mum and her granny. She lives with her mum and her granny. And she turns up at, funnily enough, she's from Bradford. She walks up the cul-de-sac where she grew up. And there's a lot of cars parked outside the house. And there's a big rowdy Punjabi sweat fest of a birthday party happening. And so, and she's accosted, cornered, the pincer move by the aunties who just want to know everything about her life. But fundamentally, when are you getting married? Because, of course, a woman can't just be happy being on her own. And also your value is equated to whether you're married and whether you have children and all of that. So I explore that. And it's about baby trying to find her identity. We meet her at the beginning and she's really in sort of a very unsettled state. She's in a place of crisis. She's left Bradford. She's moved to the big city of Manchester. She's living a life. She's bought herself a little flat. She works in marketing. And she's given 10 years of her life or 10 years of her liver to marketing. And she just never gets the promotions. And she's just baffled by how these really average white men keep getting promotions over her and have the confidence to just walk around like they own the planet. And she's just feels like she's hit a bit of a brick wall. And then you see her in her workspace, you see her in her home life and her next door neighbors who are gay best friends. And she's got, you know, the party girl. She loves to drink. And then you see her at home in her home environment with her family. And it's about, you know, how we kind of, what we were talking about, you know, turn ourselves down and dial ourselves up. But essentially, she doesn't know what the hell's going on because she's 36 and, yeah, she's single.
You described a very, very familiar...
Yep.
...setting. I feel like I'm looking around the room. There's 1, 2 people. And we're all just smiling and nodding, yes. But it's a setting that I have so much affection for.
Yeah.
It's a character that I find familiar because I there's a lot of love for that part of ourselves.
Yeah.
And yeah, the importance of our job, our work, the defining our identity. It's something that I love to hear shouted about. I love to be able to pick up a book and feel it. Like, I guess there's a validation in that.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I just wanted to create a character that doesn't exist in fiction.
Yeah.
And the thing is, when you're not allowed to be flawed. I had this conversation with my brother when I was writing the memoir, and he was like, Anita, I've been allowed to fail over and over again. I haven't. That there's no space in my life to fail. You know what? You know, I've got to just turn up, nail it, do the job. Or whatever it is, it could be home life, and it doesn't have to be work. And she still does that. She's amazing. Baby does turn up and is brilliant at work. I wanted to just paint the picture of a South Asian woman who is multifaceted, who isn't just clever and polite and does everything the right way, which is what people, I think, often see. I think I just wanted to have a bit of a messy life and be figuring things out.
For her to be allowed to be multidimensional, multifaceted is so important, because that's then what means that any little girl, any little girl from a South Asian background looking at the book can say, okay, I'm that bit, I've got a bit of that bit and that bit. It can speak to more and more girls who then realise their story is valid.
It's,
they have a story to tell. Yeah. Maybe one day they will be writing.
Just do it.
Do it.
When you're all of you dreaming of it, just do it.
Please.
We need your stories.
Please do it.
Baileys is proudly supporting the Women's Prize for Fiction by helping showcase incredible writing by remarkable women, celebrating their accomplishments and getting more of their books into the hands of more people. Baileys is the perfect adult treat, whether shaken in a cocktail, over ice cream, or paired with your favourite book. Check out baileys.com for our favourite Baileys recipes.
Hi, I'm Sam Baker and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post-40. I started The Shift because I was so tired of the absence of older women's voices. Where had all the women over 40 gone?
So, I mean, seriously, if you want to walk about in your pyjamas for the rest of your life, we're invisible.
Each episode, I speak to an inspiring woman about her shift.
I feel very strong and think I genuinely don't care what anybody thinks of me.
Join me every Tuesday, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Your third bookshelf book, Anita, is Pessimism is for Lightweights by Selena Godden. 30 pieces of courage and resistance. These poems are written for the Women's March, poems that salute peaceful protest, poems on sexism, on racism, on class discrimination, poverty and homelessness, immigration and identity, all exceptionally pertinent issues then and now, and I'm sure will be for a long time. Tell us about when you read this book.
Selena Godden. Oh my God. Have you ever met her?
No, I haven't.
She is mighty.
Okay.
I'm just getting emotional thinking about her. She's a very special human being. They don't make them quite like Selena. She's unbelievable. And when I read this, God, you know, it's like, I wish I had a copy in my hands because there's so much I want to kind of pick out from it. And I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's almost like, just the title says it all, Pessimism is for Lightweights, you know, it's that stepping into your joy. I met her quite a few years ago in Bethnal Green, York Hall. There was an event, a poetry event on, and she was performing alongside loads of other amazing people. Irvin Welsh was on the stage.
Oh, wow.
Riz Ahmed. Yeah. And I remember Selena getting up and I was just like, who is she?
Who is that?
Oh, my God. And then we had a drink afterwards and her memoir had just come out. I immediately went off and read it, needed to know everything about this woman. Like who, how, what made her, who is she? And her writing is incredible. And then, she actually came on Women's Hour to talk about this book of poetry. Afterwards, you know, you have a debrief afterwards and there wasn't a woman in the office who wasn't just like, we love Selena. We want to go for a drink with her. We want to be in her company. Just some people just have the capacity to write and it's so meaningful and so truthful and so uplifting. And you know, sometimes you can get really blooming down and depressed, and I'm a joyful person,
epic.
I know it.
Right?
I know it.
Some people are just really miserable. And also, we're a country that likes a bit of a moan.
Yeah.
We love a moan. But I mean, I don't know. Like, life is so precious.
You've only got a very short amount of time really trying to have a nice one.
Yeah.
Really trying to enjoy it.
And so, you know, based on the conversation we've been having and all that, like, there's lots of people ask me this about, younger women ask me, when they do come to me and say, look, I'm having a really tough time at work, or whatever it is, can you give me any advice? And I always say, no, you need to retain your joy, you need to find your joy. Don't let them sap your joy from you, because that is really out of order. And the only way to do that is by finding your crew. Who are the people that you can turn to who are going to just pick you up and go, we see you, you're all right, come on, get back in there and do what you got to do. And if you haven't got that person, then get this book. Selena will be that person through her words. There's an amazing poem called Courage is a Muscle. I mean, all of them. Yeah, so she just brings the joy and lifts you. She's a lifter and her words are magnificent. Yeah, I can't wait to see what she does next.
I think you're a lifter, Anita. I genuinely do. Every time I've talked to you, whatever I've been feeling, I've felt just a little bit more confident, a little bit more sure of myself, and then my joy comes, you know?
Yeah.
I just need to sometimes take a breath, and you're an encourager of taking a breath.
Thank you.
And then remembering who the fuck you are.
Yeah, never forget that.
Because you sometimes do. And I read an interview that you did with Women and Home quite recently. It said, I think women get better with age.
Yes.
The more confident you become, the less you give a shit, the more spectacular you are. I love this. Because I know what you mean, that sort of being sure of yourself and then feeling really spectacular because of it. Have you found your confidence increasing with age, and how has that sort of manifested itself?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I've decided, Vic, whatever comes out of my mouth has to be truthful and meaningful. I think, you know, been working in this wonderful, strange industry for quite a long time now. I don't want to date myself, but anyway, you know, over 20 years. And it's been a real journey and a real process. And now finally, I feel like I've got to a place. This sounds weird to say, but almost like the place where it's like, all right, let's go. Not the place, just this, almost like the start. It's like, now I'm like, all right, finally I've got to the baseline where I'm like, come on, let's really see what this is all about. And maybe it is hitting 45. It feels like a really significant age to be a woman. Like someone said to me when I was turning 40, oh, the woman you are at 40 to the woman you are at 50 is completely different. Like, just wait, see what happens. I was like, what? And I got to 45 and I'm like, yeah, this is wild. This is amazing. And it's almost like this urgency where, I don't know, you feel confident, you've worked hard to get to where you are, and you know that you're what you're capable of. I used to walk into meetings with extreme gratitude, like, thank you so much, and I'm doffing my cap and my shoulders are up here and my eyes are wide, and I'm like, oh my god, like, who was that person? Now I'm like, yeah, just sitting in a room and I'm just gonna look opposite you and say, yeah, come on then, I know what I'm good for, you know what I'm good for, what are we doing? And yeah, and I just feel, I don't know, I can't even, it's not even tangible, there's just something inside me, and I'm still in the process of it. I feel sexier as well. Now I'm like, yeah, I want to wear that dress that Vic's got on.
I do not care what anyone thinks.
Amazing. I wish I'd felt that young when I was younger. I really do. But it's okay. Everyone's journey is its journey. But yes, it is a wonderful, liberating place to be. And I don't care either. I really don't. But I mean, obviously we do a little bit.
You want people to like the thing that you're making, because you're making it out of the place of love. Like, I want you to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Genuinely.
Yeah.
Like this podcast. Obviously I care what people think. I want to be listening. I care what you think, because I want you to enjoy the chats and the books, but it comes from a different plane.
Yes.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, it just feels really, really great and important, and important because there's work to be done. You know, I feel like I've got to this place, and what do I do with it? What do I do with this privilege?
But no, it's like changing the landscape for the next generation, right?
I took Women's Hour to Glastonbury.
I am so happy to see you at the helm of Women's Hour. Talk to me quickly about that sort of trajectory, that the journey to that point through broadcasting.
I had no idea that was going to ever come up.
Right. It wasn't a goal that you had.
No. Absolutely not. I mean, it just wasn't even on the agenda. I never even thought that it would be part of my journey at all.
listened to Women's Hour my whole life and just thought Radio 4, Women's Hour, you know, it's a different space. And then, yeah, it kind of just came out of the blue, really. The Friday show was up and the application process, they had an application process just for the Friday slot. And I think I was the last person to apply. And I just remember writing that I always get into Ubers and ask them to put Radio 4 on. And it's always Women's Hour and it's always an Asian taxi driver and they're always talking about vaginas. And I'm just dying in the back. Like, sorry, uncle. And then I thought, and finally it will be me.
And now I will be the voice talking about vaginas.
And I love it. And honestly, I was petrified. Absolutely petrified when I first got the job. And then had a moment of clarity where I thought, they've given you it because they want you to be you. So just be you. So yeah, you know, we're talking about confidence. When I got that gig, I was like, oh my God. And now oh my God, I love it. It's the biggest buzz. I get to interview the most amazing women on the planet. And the stories the privilege of hearing those stories and, you know, people opening up their hearts and the listeners who get in touch and share their stories, all of it. I mean, I'm still only 2 years in, but it's wild. I love it.
Talking about vaginas, we've moved on to your fourth book, Shelby Book, which is How to Be a Woman by Catlin Moran, the multi-award-winning, honest and witty memoir written with the intention of making feminism more accessible for women. In doing so, Catlin shares the stories of her life struggles from being bullied at the age of 13 for her androgynous style and a lack of motherly guidance from puberty to a hilarious, lengthy rant about the joys of pubic hair. Catlin makes a point of dispelling the stereotype that all feminists are angry man haters and addresses the smaller issues within the home that feminism wants to fix. How can you pick this one?
I have to give a shout out to Catlin Moran. There's a direct link between her, that memoir, me reading that, to fast forward about 14 years to me writing your own memoir. I mean, A, she's amazing. But you're bloody amazing. Look, Vic's even got a docs on. So you're in the room with us, Catlin.
So true, you know.
She's here.
It's, yeah. What a signature.
I know. She's a badass. Just her way with words and also her style.
Yeah.
It's like she's sitting in the room with you and she catches you off guard where you're just reading it and then she'll just throw in a comment that makes you laugh out loud on a train, like weep with laughter. So you're like, did she just say that? When I read it, I remember thinking, my God, she's just saying it. And I remember feeling, I'm always amazed by, traditionally have been amazed by people who have the capacity to own their shame. Because my shame has been so shameful. But I also remember thinking, wow, is it because she is white that she's able to do this? That you can just talk about sex? And yeah, because that is my experience, because I was never able to do it. My mates were all able to just stand around and I used to skirt on the periphery of their conversations. Even with my own friends, I felt shameful talking about anything vaguely, you know, to do with women. So it felt so incredible reading her book where she just put it all out there. And once she did that, it gives everyone else permission to just talk about it, doesn't it? And so there is a reason, actually. So it is a proper shout out, respect. Thank you, Catlin, because it was also, fast forward, the reason I was then able to say, why, well, maybe I need to write about the brown girl experience.
I know in a recent interview, you called yourself a born feminine.
Yeah.
I'd love to know what kind of role feminism has played in your life. Do you have like early memories of looking around the world and thinking, I would like to see more equality?
Yeah, maybe. I think growing up, just realizing that the boys have it much easier, but then you don't realize you're a feminist. I remember wanting to be a boy when I was little, but not in the kind of, I want to actually be, but just wishing that like the boys have it so much easier. Like my mum would, it would be me that would be dragged in for various reasons to not play outside, whether it's don't go in the sun. My brother was never told to not go in the sun.
Colorism. Yes, of course, but it doesn't apply to the boys.
Doesn't apply to the boys. He can do what he likes. Or, you know, just all of it. And I just, yeah, hated it. Absolutely hated it. But it gave me something to rebel against. But also sort of didn't lean into my femininity. Didn't want to be a girly girl. So would Rob Doc Martis still do to this day? And Black Nail Varnish. And yeah, it was just, so there was a fire in my belly that I wanted something more and I wanted something different. And And that's why I think South Asian women are one of the most successful demographics in this country, because we realise we're not going to get handed everything on a silver platter like the Little Prince, you know, and born into the same household. So we have to go out and do something for ourselves. So, yeah, you go out there and strive so that you have some power, I guess.
On wanting something different, you said in the past that you didn't fit in. I think often as a kid, you do really want to fit in, but it's nice to reframe that as actually standing out. How have you used standing out to your advantage?
I think I've always been quite confident. I think that is something that I've just had. So I didn't really... It's not that I wanted to stand out. I didn't care about fitting in. I've really never cared about fitting in. Even though, you know, obviously there's spaces where you want to fit in, work being one of them, where you kind of dial yourself down. But actually, I've never compared myself to anybody, and I've never looked at anyone and thought, I want to be just like her. Apart from Roisin Murphy and Salma Hayek, I want to be them, both of them. I want to be their love child, please. Weird. Okay. Roisin's meant to be coming on Radio 4 in a couple of weeks, I think.
Please, sure.
I think her agent's on the phone cancelling right now. Don't go anywhere near that weird woman. Yeah, so yeah, standing out. It's good. It's good. In fact, you know what? I didn't do it enough. I would implore the next generation, just stand out.
Yeah.
Be you. Because actually they need you to be you. Don't take your edges off. Don't do what I did, which was shave off your edges, because then you wake up at 45 and you realise, oh my God, who the hell was that? So yeah, just stand out. Stand out more.
You will regrow your edges, this is the thing. But you know what? If you learn from an early age that you don't need to shave them off, then you've got even more life to enjoy them.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Anita, it's time to talk about your fifth and final book, which is The Brilliant Wahala by Nikki May.
It's wicked.
Yeah, it is. I read this a couple of years ago and was just really pleasantly surprised. It's sort of picked up by chance. It's about Ronka, Simi and Boo, who are three mixed-race friends living in London. They have the gift of two cultures there. Nigerian and English, like myself. They navigate frustrated hopes and thwarted love until a single terrible act threatens to spin their lives out of control. Fearlessly political about class, colorism and clones, this spellbinding debut is for anyone who has ever cherished friendship.
You make it there.
I loved it.
Yeah,
I loved it. Read it, couldn't put it down, and I thought, this is what I want to read. I want to read stories about all women, and just that it isn't about them being Nigerian. It is just incidental. Yeah. But that's who they are, you know. And it's also about who's writing those stories. And it was Nikki May's debut, I think.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, and I just thought, what a badass.
Yeah.
Good on you, girl. And I interviewed her and she said, you know, I wanted to represent Black women in a way that they haven't been represented before. And they're middle class, successful. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
You know, when do you see that?
No, you just don't.
I mean, things are changing now. And I think we're really acutely aware that we need to tell all stories, but also who is telling the stories? That's the important thing. And so, you know, I think, again, there's a lot of books here that I'm going to, you know, give shout outs to, because it made me think that there is space for a story about a brown girl as well, who is multifaceted. And maybe there's a story that I could tell. And so, yeah, I absolutely enjoyed it. And the food. In fact, I said to Nikki, let's go for lunch. I need to go to a Nigerian restaurant with you and eat. Because I remember being very hungry reading it.
It's a very visceral book. The descriptions are so palpable. They fizz off the page and it just is delicious. Especially when you recognise these dishes. Like this lot that's like my mum's cooking.
I mean, I loved it. I loved reading it. I loved her style. I love, it's just a really great book that takes you into another world. You fall in love with the characters. You feel like you're their fourth friend. You feel that you're sitting with them when they're going through the, you know, when they're having their lunch or whatever that they meet up for. Yeah. And so I really like the style of writing and I wanted to eat food so badly. Still do.
Between being on the radio, on the telly, writing a memoir and also writing, you know, a piece of fiction, you are really using your platform to make a positive impact, to tell stories, to help next generation know that their stories are worth telling, and also to bring attention to important issues. Why is it important to you to be able to speak to others through whatever way?
So someone asked me the other day whether I always thought when I started working in TV that I was there to represent. Honestly, Vic, never. When I left Bradford and came down the M1 all them moons ago on horse and cart, I genuinely just thought, I'm off to that there London to make something of myself, and nothing can stop me because the world's mine for the taking. And wanting to work in music, TV, I was ahead of my time. Worked at Top of the Pops, worked at the Ozone, worked as a music researcher, did loads of stuff. And then I just realised, it's just a little bit harder for me, isn't it? People don't see me the way I see myself. That's weird. My God, people see my ethnicity. Come on, before anything else. So that's okay. It's kind of your journey. It makes you, makes you stronger and all of that. It's all good. But now that I'm here, yeah, it's like I've got a proper purpose, definitely. And I think that started with making my Who Do You Think You Are and the reaction to that. And people saying, how do we not know this story about partition? How do we not know? And my mates were like, it's because you told it and people want to know. And I thought, okay, maybe. So then I wrote the memoir and that reaction was huge. And now it feels like, yeah, this, I'm not representing, I'm just presenting as myself. And if that helps people, then that's all good.
It makes you think, actually, doesn't it? Well, now that we're here, let's do it.
Yeah, and exactly the same as you. Like, you're just being yourself, but just by being you and being visible and being brilliant and just being you is inspiring. It's really difficult, isn't it? Because of course you are representing, and of course it's like another layer of stuff that we have to think about. Just wish it wasn't always on us to have to think about everything.
I'm going to make you think about one more.
Yeah, go on there.
If you had to choose one book from the five that you've wrote today, did anyone tell you you'd have to do this?
No.
I'm so sorry. I do apologise. What's as your favourite? Which would it be and why? Okay, so we've got Wahala. We've got How to Be a Woman. We've got Pessimism is for Lightweights. We've got Somebody Loves You. And we had Sophia Princess Suffragette Revolutionary.
Yeah. Selena Godden.
Is it?
Yeah. Give me that book. Pessimism is for Lightweights, because whatever you're feeling, you just delve into that and you're boosted.
Sometimes with poetry, it's nice because you can dip in and out as well.
Yeah.
When you need it. I might need that poem today, or that one's like a little pick and mix.
Yeah, and it's distilled. You know, I'm just in awe of poets and that distillation of words.
Potent.
Yeah. Like, oh my God, three words and they've just hit my heart. Yeah. Like a punch. They've stabbed me. Oh, magnificent.
It's honestly been the best having you.
I've loved it, and you're amazing, and this has been spectacular, and keep going.
And best of luck, Baby Does It Run.
Thank you. Yeah, it's out. Please read it, buy it, and tell me what you think. It's only if it's a good review. Don't tell me if you think it sucks.
I'm Vic Hope, and you've been listening to the Women's Prize for Fiction podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Baileys and produced by Birdline Media. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.